You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, humans have tried to control water for a long time, but what about when it fights back? We'll talk with the author of a new book about how we can better live with water and adapt to it. Now, it's no secret that stress isn't good for you, but researchers are still learning more about just how harmful it is. A study published last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found a correlation between high levels of stress and faster aging of the immune system. It adds to growing research about the connections between our mental and physical health, and it highlights the importance of stress management and relief. We're talking about that connection now, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed stress affecting your health? What are the biggest impacts stress has on you? How do you feel it? Have you found effective ways to reduce it? What questions do you have about stress and your physical health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Dean. It's such a pleasure to be joining you today. I'm a longtime listener, so this is a really fun opportunity.
Well, great to have you with us. Melissa, I want to start by defining some terms, if we're able. Is there a working definition for what stress actually is in the body?
There is, and I think we can all agree that what an individual finds stressful is going to vary widely from person to person. But in the field of stress research, generally, a definition that's agreed upon is a demands that we perceive to exceed our ability to cope. And so that, because of the perceived aspect of it, that is why what is defined as stress varies from individual to individual.
And inside our bodies, when we feel stressed and we are kind of feeling that we're unable to cope, are there things, physical things happening in our bodies that as a researcher you look to and say, there's the stress response?
Absolutely. And this, the what's considered the stress response is really a coordinated and complex set of physiological changes that are well suited to support survival and our protection in situations that we would have encountered through most of human history and are appropriate for supporting our well-being in those contexts, but generally aren't well suited for the types of stressors that we experience as modern humans. And those changes are things like an increase in heart rate, an increase in mobilization of glucose from stores in our body, an increase in stress hormones. Some people might be familiar with the word cortisol, which is a hormone that's released from our adrenal glands that helps to mobilize these processes. Adrenaline, which is another hormone, also known as epinephrine, is released from the adrenal glands during stress. And these are things that we measure when we want sort of an objective measure of engagement, of stress physiology. But that experience can be interpreted differently for different people.
And when we talk about negative health impacts that these stress hormones can have, especially when they're, I imagine, released over a long period of time, multiple times, what can you talk about the range of health impacts that we see with stress?
Sure. And it really is, I think you hit the nail on the head here. It's the long-term accumulation that we're talking about when we think of the effects of stress on health. Stress is, and the hormones that are associated with stress, the physiology is really essential, actually, to our survival. But it's the repeated engagement of these systems frequently and chronically over long periods of time that causes wear and tear on our bodies. And so you can think of our bodies similar to how we would think of a car, that the normal functioning is doing what it's supposed to do. But when we really press that system, like if we're driving really hard and then we brake really fast, repeatedly over time, it's going to cause wear and tear. on that car. And our bodies are the same way. So you can think of when you would mobilize glucose from stores repeatedly and frequently over time, that might be associated with an increased risk for type 2 diabetes or the accumulation of adiposity or fat stores over time in our body that's associated with long-term health problems. Or if you get a frequent acceleration in blood pressure and heart rate over time, that's going to cause wear and tear on your cardiovascular system and be associated with greater risk of heart attack or cardiovascular disease or stroke. We can think of you know, the effects of stress on our musculoskeletal system and the likelihood that we'll experience chronic pain. Really, I often think of stress as amplifying vulnerabilities, like low-level underlying vulnerabilities that may not, you know, give rise to an actual physical symptom without that stress, but with stress present, it sort of amplifies the underlying vulnerabilities that are there anyway.
And do those stress hormones only get released in those quick moments, or is there, I don't know, such a thing as a slow drip of stress?
Oh, that's a great question. The hormones that are associated with stress and the physiological systems are not just involved in the stress response, but they're involved in the maintenance of our day-to-day life. And so they're really essential for our functioning, and we wouldn't want to make them go away. That would be really problematic. But what's important is how is the appropriate response given the context and the regulation of that response. So turning it on when it's needed and turning it off when it isn't needed. But I suspect that your question has more to do with sort of low level chronic stressors that are sort of ever present. You can think of that in terms of like the demands, the low-level work stress that's sort of always eating at the back of our minds. And yes, those types of experiences are often associated with elevations in stress hormones that aren't following sort of the normal, healthy, regulated pattern. And those are the types of patterns that we would associate with increased risk of chronic diseases and ultimately increased risk of mortality or earlier mortality than we would have without those stressors present.
We're talking with Melissa Rosenkranz right now, assistant professor of psychiatry at UW-Madison. We're looking at the relationship between mental stress and physical ill effects in the body. Melissa, I know one thing that you study a lot is inflammation and stress. You mentioned mm-hmm. some of the negative health impacts stress can have before. Is inflammation a part of those showing up in different ways?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think inflammation is one of the sort of common denominators that connects the diseases that are associated with chronic stress. And I don't mean to say that inflammation is a bad thing. Like our stress responses, inflammation is an absolutely essential part of our immune response. And it's really the first line of defense when we have a scrape or we are infected with a pathogen. But inflammation is also mobilized during stress. And really, you can think about that in relationship to the types of stressors that we would have faced during evolutionary time, like fleeing a predator or fighting for our territory or fighting for a meal, and the likelihood that we're going to have a break in our skin or we're going to be damaged in some way. And so the immune response, the brain's perception of that stressful experience launches kind of a preemptive inflammatory response to prepare for the encounter of those pathogens. And so that would be very appropriate and helpful to us in sort of this evolutionary time scale. But when most of the stressors that we experience are, you know, tension with our spouse or managing all of our kids' activities or microaggressions that we might face in the world, that launching that preemptive inflammatory response is not going to be helpful. And it's going to contribute to the underlying conditions that give rise to some of the diseases that I've already mentioned. And those very same stress hormones in an acute situation suppress inflammation. But when those stress hormones occur sort of at low levels over a long period of time, they actually promote inflammation and they promote some of these diseases that I've talked about. And that's a really key part of what we're looking for with interventions that target stress reduction as a mechanism.
We're talking about stress and the impact on your health with UW-Madison psychiatry professor Melissa Rosenkranz. Want to get into some of those interventions you mentioned, Melissa, in just a bit. But first, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What stress management tools have you had success with? Do you practice mindfulness? Have you ever meditated? How has it gone for you? And if you've managed to reduce stress in your life, have you seen positive health effects? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Melissa Rosenkranz. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison, with us today looking at the negative impacts of stress and the ways we can manage and reduce stress, also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How does stress affect your life? How do you feel it physically? Have you learned to manage stress, and have you seen physical benefits as a result? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melissa, before the break, you mentioned health interventions. You also said that stress is often, you know, only one part of many factors that could be causing a health problem. That said, when someone wants to cut that variable of stress out, what kind of things can they do? What do you advise?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are lots of ways that we can reduce our stress, and some that are better studied than others. And I think it's a really individual question. Some things work really well, or people are drawn to a particular lifestyle more than others. And you did mention mindfulness meditation, which is an intervention that I and my group here in Madison have studied, and others around the country as well. And that works really well for some people. But not everybody is drawn to interventions or practices like meditation. And there are other things that we can do, like exercise is probably one of the very best ways to reduce stress and to improve the regulation of your immune system. And sleep, I think exercise and sleep are like two really, really big factors that you can imagine if somebody is experiencing a lot of stress. Sleep is one of the things that's going to take a big hit. And sleep is extremely important for optimal function of the immune system. So whatever you can do in terms of having a good routine and good sleep hygiene is going to really help both reduce stress, but also improve your immune system's function in not responding when it should, not responding when it shouldn't, and responding when it should. But if we want to talk about specific practices like mindfulness, there's a fair amount of research suggesting that mindfulness practice can be really beneficial in reducing stress, for sure. But having that reduction in stress translate into more optimal function of the immune system as well. And I can talk about the specifics of that if we're interested, or we can take questions from callers.
Well, you mentioned earlier that stress sort of throws off our natural rhythms of releasing things like glucose and stress hormones. Do things like sleep and exercise sort of help reset that natural rhythm in the body?
They do, for sure. And as you can imagine, all of these things go hand in hand. So if you're exercising more, you're going to sleep better, you're going to have better circadian rhythms of stress hormones and immune system function. If you're sleeping well, you're going to be more likely to, you know, have the resources to exercise or to meditate or to do the things that you know are good to support your well-being. And so all of these things go hand in hand. And if you can do one of them, great. If you can do multiple of these things, even better.
I want to go to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Dean, who's driving on the road right now. I believe pulled over. Dean, hello.
Well, hello there. I'm a 16-year stroke survivor, and because there is no defined protocols on how to recover, no one knows. There's a huge amount of anxiety about getting back to your previous life, which probably causes the 23% of stroke survivors to get PTSD.
And Dean, have you found things in the wake of your own stroke that have helped you sort of manage those stressors, those expectations?
Oh, well, not really.
Gotcha. Dean, thank you for calling in. I'm so sorry to hear about that. Melissa, obviously you can't recommend things on or diagnose anything, but what sort of things could someone in Dean's position start thinking about in terms of how to reduce some of that stress and the outlook?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that some of the practices that mindfulness, I think mindfulness actually is a really great thing to think about in these situations, because one of the things that mindfulness emphasizes is being with what is and practicing acceptance, and maybe having your attention focused on the things that are going well and what new things might arise that wasn't part of your life prior to having a stroke. Even if things have shifted and you don't have the same abilities that you did before, what's new in your world that may not have been part of it before that might be a positive? And to think about what functions you may be able to regain, and having that acceptance might actually help in the process of regaining some of those functions or finding new ways of functioning in the world given the capacities that you have.
Dean, thanks for that call. We're talking with Melissa Rosenkrantz of UW-Madison right now, looking at the relationship between stress and physical health. Melissa, we've been talking about mindfulness, meditation, and I think sometimes there can be it's a big industry, but there can sometimes be a bit of a reluctance from some people to try it out or being not sure where to start. I'll say for my own part, I had never done yoga until about a year and a half ago. Now I really like it. For someone who has never thought about doing meditation or mindfulness, where should they start?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think this is a wonderful time to explore mindfulness meditation if it's something that you are curious about, because it's never been more accessible than it is now. There are apps that can be used out there that are free in some cases to download, that can be personalized and can require as little as, you know, 5 minutes a day or as, you know, as much as you want to engage with it. But apps aren't right for everybody either. Some people don't like to learn that way. They're not learners in that way that an app presents material. And so for individuals like that, finding a group, you know, there are mindfulness-based stress reduction courses that are taught throughout the city that are totally and completely secular. And so some people have reservations about learning to meditate because they think it's associated with a particular religious tradition. And that is true. Meditation practices are part of many different types of religious traditions, from Christianity to Buddhism to Judaism to Islam. But there are plenty of meditation courses that are out there that are separated from any sort of spiritual tradition and are completely accessible to someone who hasn't had any practice before and who's curious and maybe wants to meet other people. I think that's one of the benefits of the in-person courses, is that you also have the experiences of others with these practices to share in your own journey. And so there are lots of options for a diverse range of styles of learning.
And Melissa, our peg for this conversation was a study involving researchers from USC about how stress ages the immune system and makes certain immune cells behave differently over time. I know you weren't part of that study specifically, but looking at it, was there anything that surprised you? What were your thoughts?
No, it really didn't surprise me. I mean, you know, the immune system ages naturally. The ability of our immune system to rise to the challenges of the viruses and bacteria that we're exposed to decreases over time. It actually peaks generally during adolescence, as depressing as that might sound. But the rate at which the immune system function declines varies widely. And stress is one of the factors that determines the rate at which the function of the immune system declines. And so it really didn't surprise me. And it corroborates a lot of what we already know. And there are other research, actually, some that come to mind immediately are from Alyssa Eppel, who is a professor at the University of California in San Francisco, who studied another aspect of cellular aging called that's related to the length of a part of the cell called a telomere, which are just little ends of the chromosomes that protect the chromosomes. And we know that the length of a telomere is related to aging, but also to the amount of stress we experience. And there have been studies showing that the length of those telomeres can be buffered by behavioral practices like meditation. And so I think, though we know that stress does impact the rate at which the immune system and other cells in the body age, there are things that we can do to slow that down.
Well, Melissa, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Melissa Rosenkranz is an assistant professor of psychiatry and distinguished chair in contemplative neuroscience at the Center for Healthy Minds at the UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the connection between stress and our health and share ways to reduce and manage stress. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, medical debt affects more than 100 million people in the U.S. That's according to a new project from Kaiser Health News. We'll look at how costs got so high and what can be done about it. Also, the potential impact of allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. All that and more tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Our next guest says that much of the water we see today, bodies of water that is, are not in their natural states. Not true wild rivers, creeks, streams, etc. That's because humans have altered and engineered our world to control water. And it's time more of us accept the idea that water is ultimately going to do what it wants. She says that understanding what water wants is one of the keys to adapting to the excessive highs and lows of water that are being caused by climate change. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How connected do you feel to the water where you live? How do you observe or monitor it? Have you been impacted by a flood or a drought, or multiple floods or droughts? What about high lake levels? Have you made a big life change like moving away? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic explorer. She writes about water, climate change, plants, and animals for Scientific American, The New York Times, Nature, The Atlantic, and more. She also co-founded the environmental news startups Climate Confidential and This Week in Earth. Her latest book is called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking about this concept of water not being free. You bring up the phrase free river and talk about the first time you saw one in Alaska. Could you tell us about that moment and why it was so impactful for you?
Yeah, I grew up in California, which is arguably the apex of water engineering. There's just so many dams and irrigation canals and aqueducts, and everything is very tightly controlled. And I was in Denali National Park in Alaska hiking with some friends. And we came to this river that was probably about 40 feet across and fairly fast moving. And we weren't going to be able to cross it. And I looked up the floodplain, and it was braided, and there were strands of it that were sort of twining together and apart. And I realized that this is what a river is supposed to look like, you know, not this very straight canal, which is certainly what I had experienced growing up in California. And I think people in a lot of places around the world, you know, the streams and creeks and rivers that they know are quite constrained like that.
That was something that was really interesting to me reading your book, that even things that I might think of as, oh, that's just a natural river, have actually been shaped and molded by humans over time. Can you talk about some of the more natural ways that water wants to move and does move that we might not expect or have forgotten about?
Yeah, I think so. One of the key ideas in my book is slow water. And all of the people in my book who are trying to do things a different way are looking to recreate or restore some of the natural slow phases of water. So think about wetlands and swamps and floodplains, something that people in the Midwest are very familiar with, high altitude meadows and mountains covered with forests that generate rain. These are all places where water in its natural state would be soaking into the ground. And a lot of important things happen when water and the ground interact. It prevents flooding because the ground is absorbing excess water. It supplies water to streams in the dry season because the underground system is very large and complex. And so water very slowly returns to the stream into the dry season. So there are many things like that. And what I think we don't realize is the extent to which we have eradicated these natural slow phases. So here's kind of a mind-blowing statistic. Since 1700, humans have erased 87% of the world's wetlands. So that is a vast, vast area that is no longer able to absorb water in its natural way. And so, you know, when we pave on top of those, we fill them in, we plant on them, then the water just speeds off really quickly. So that causes flooding, and then it also causes drought later. So one of the big points in my book is, yes, climate change is causing these water extremes. It's bringing bigger rainstorms with more water, longer, more severe droughts, 20 years and counting in the US Southwest. But a significant part of these problems we're experiencing with water is our development decisions. So that's urban sprawl, it's industrial agriculture, and it's the concrete control-oriented ways that we've tried to manage water. So the good news about that is there's a lot we can do to change that, even separate from reducing emissions, which of course we also need to do.
One of the things that you wrote about, which is a factor that might actually make flooding worse when it happens rather than its intended purpose of controlling water, is the levee. Can you talk about the levee effect and the research that's going into that?
Yeah, I came across this really fascinating field of study called sociohydrology, and that is just what it sounds like. It's humans and water impact. So for a long time, hydrologists would measure flows in rivers and not really consider what humans were doing. But levees, in fact, have a significant effect on what happens to the water because, of course, they're constraining the river and keeping it from its floodplain. So it's well known, even by experts who build levees, that the more levees you put up, the higher the water will be. In fact, flood levels near St. Louis, Missouri, have increased up to 13 feet over the 20th century. And that's largely due to building of levees and restricting access to the floodplain. You know, the water can't spread out, so it just goes higher. It's kind of common sense. But the levee effect is a sociological impact where, you know, you build a levee and humans think, oh, this area is safe. It's protected. It's flooding less often. So more people move in there. They build their businesses and homes there. And levees, water people have a joke, which you may have heard. There are two kinds of levees, ones that have failed and ones that are going to fail. And there are reasons for that, which we can go into if we have time. But when you have all those people living in a floodplain, behind a levee, they have this false sense of security. And then when the levee does fail, it's even more catastrophic because more people are at risk.
We're talking with Erica Guise right now, author of the new book, Water Always Wins. And Erica, in addition to the slow water movement today, you also go back in time and look for examples from the past, from the pre-industrial era. One of those that you return to in the book several times is the marsh dwellers in Iraq. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's such an interesting civilization. People have been living on top of the marshes in Mesopotamia, right? The Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the cradle of civilization, for more than 9,000 years. You know, the ancient Sumerian civilization evolved out of the marsh dweller civilization about 6,000 years ago. And people today still live on top of the marshes. They use the reeds that grow there, Phragmites, which is invasive and kind of cursed elsewhere, but it's native there and it's incredibly fast growing and strong. They use it to build their homes, to build their animal paddocks, to build these islands that they live on that are on top of the marsh. And they really view the marsh as the source of all life, and they have a real caretaking attitude toward it. And it just kind of blew my mind because in dominant culture, you know, we really think of wetlands as wastelands. And often what we try to do is fill them in and build on top of them, you know, make the land worthwhile or make it pay in some way. And yet here people have lived in harmony with wetlands, with marshes for more than 9,000 years.
We're talking with journalist Erica Guise about her new book called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about flooding or droughts where you live? If you live along the coasts here in Wisconsin, have you noticed a change in the water levels or erosion? If you farm, have you been impacted by flooding? How do you think we could do things differently here to account for what water wants to do? What planning would you like to see from the local or state government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with journalist Erica Guise, author of the new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience with flooding you want to share? Do you have questions about how water works and how we can learn to live with it? That's 800-642-1234. Erica, for your book, you spend time with a lot of hydrologists and water engineers, and that includes beavers. I want to talk about beavers. Can you tell us what they do to waterways and what we can learn from them?
Well, they're definitely the cutest water engineers, in my opinion. beavers are semi-aquatic rodents. They prefer to spend most of their time in the water because they feel safe there from predators. And to do that, to have more area in which to harvest food and move around, they build dams, which create ponds. And of course, ponds are a great example of slow water. And there's been some interesting studies about how much water they're moving underground and storing and what impact that can have, how that correlates to a city's water supply, et cetera. And it's more important with climate change, especially in places that rely on mountain snow for water, because there's less of that now. So if you can instead capture that winter water, if the beavers can capture it and move it underground, then again, it will continue to supply natural hydrology, natural streams in the dry season. And the thing about beavers is they can address both flooding and drought. In England, they have a lot of old towns built right along rivers, and they have had a lot of terrible floods across the country in recent years. And beavers were completely eradicated, killed about 400 years ago there. And so now people have brought beavers back in, and they are documenting, researchers are measuring how much it delays the water flow to prevent flooding. So it's kind of like flattening the curve in the coronavirus pandemic, where you want to, you know, try to not get it, and so you don't overload the hospital all at once. And similarly, the Beaver slows the water, so it's still, the water is going out, but over a longer period of time to reduce flooding. And then in the Western U.S. and Washington and elsewhere, they're trying to, yeah, replace the snow storage with Beaver storage to help weather droughts. And interestingly, beaver ponds are a really important fire break as well. Obviously, the water isn't going to burn, but they also raise the water table around the pond, which makes more water available to the plants. And so therefore, they're less desiccated and less likely to burn. And historically, beavers were all across the United States. And so it was a much wetter landscape than we think is natural. So if we can help the beaver continue their comeback from when we nearly killed them all, you know, we'll have that resource for us in the Western U.S. where we desperately need more water on the land.
One of my favorite things in the book was a 1950 artistic rendering from the Idaho Fish and Game Service of beavers being parachuted in to mountainous regions to take place in a water restoration project that they were doing.
Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, people have actually realized that how beavers can heal natural water watersheds for at least 100 years. So starting in the 1920s, Idaho, California, they were reintroducing beavers from farming areas where they were getting in farmers' way to mountain areas where they could repair stream systems. And then people kind of forgot about it for a while. But yeah, the parachutes were because it was just after World War II, and some of the areas were so remote that there wasn't really road access to truck in the beavers. And so they tried parachuting them in quite successfully. In fact, there's only one beaver fatality from parachuting that I'm aware of. So it was an interesting experiment.
I want to go to our callers now. We have James in Reedsburg with us. Hi, James.
Hello. So I went to school for wildlife ecology in Stevens Point, and we talked a lot about wetlands and as well as the benefits beavers provide for an ecosystem. And wetlands, I mean, I kind of look at them as like the corals of the land. You know, they have such diverse ecosystems down from the micro organisms that live there all the way up to the macro organisms. And they're great. They're nature's purifiers. I mean, they water that goes in there is dirt, you know, dirty and brown, and you can't see through it. And when it comes out, it's crystal clear. It's amazing to see that process.
James, thanks for the
that.
Call.
I
yeah,
love
Erica,
that.
Take it away.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say I really love that analogy, the corals of the land. I'm gonna keep that one in mind.
Yeah, we don't have coral reefs here in Wisconsin, but we do have wetlands. And as James said, they have a cleansing effect on the water. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, slow water in its various guises is very important for cleaning water as well. And providing food, like, you know, he was kind of alluding to that with all of the biodiversity that can be found in wetlands. But that's true of floodplains, too. There have been some interesting studies in California with salmon showing that salmon who are allowed to spend time lingering on watery floodplains like they did historically are 12 times fatter. You know, they're better fed. And so they're much healthier and much more able to, you know, weather what comes. And we have this kind of like fish versus farmers debate, but in fact, that's a myth. Like fish and farmers can use the same water and be better for it. They're using it at different times of the year.
I want to talk about some of the ways we can adapt for the future and perhaps relocate, perhaps redesign. What are some of the ways that you're seeing communities do that, particularly here in the Midwest?
Yeah, I think one example that your listeners may be familiar with is Nahant Marsh in Illinois. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm a writer, not a speaker. Yeah, it's near Davenport, Illinois, and it's a wetland that they restored right near the urban area. And during the big 2019 floods, it absorbed as much as 1 trillion gallons of flood water. And Davenport did eventually flood a little bit, but less than it would have otherwise. And, you know, the problem is, if you think about that 87% of wetlands that we've removed, you know, water needs a lot of space that it's not getting. So Davenport can do this marsh and they can have a small impact, but what's really needed are marsh restorations along the watershed, so that every little bit can, you know, absorb some of it rather than raise the levels like the levee effect that we were talking about. And interestingly, like restoring wetlands on just 1.5% of a landscape can reduce the height and volume of flood peaks by as much as 29%. So it can be a really big bang for the buck. So that's a really great way to make space for water close to human settlements and within human settlements. And then, of course, in some cases, people are retreating from the river when they've flooded repeatedly. And the Midwest is actually the earliest example that I'm aware of this phenomenon in the United States. It's getting a lot of press now in coastal areas because of climate change and sea level rise. You know, there are many rivers in the Midwest, including, of course, the Great Mississippi System and Missouri and Arkansas. And so people have dealt with flooding for a really long time and sometimes repeated flooding. If we have time for another story about Soldier Grove, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that seemed to be an instance where relocating a town actually made financial sense.
Yeah. So interestingly, some of these small towns decide together that they're going to move the whole town together. And usually this happens after a series of floods when people are just tired of rebuilding. And they, in the early 80s, they talked to the Army Corps of Engineers because they thought, well, maybe we need a levee to stop all this flooding. And the Army Corps said that it was going to cost $7 million, which was actually triple what the buildings downtown were worth. So they were kind of outraged by that, but also there would be additional ongoing bills forever for the long-term upkeep of the levee, and that would have bankrupted the town. So they collectively decided we're not doing that, and they all moved together.
Erica, in just our last minute or so, adapting to the way water naturally wants to move is going to take a shift, and it's going to take a bit of an ego check for humans in a way. How do you think we should start that shift in reframing the conversation?
Well, you know, the way we relate to water is not mandatory. There are many cultures around the world, including many indigenous cultures, that see water instead of as a commodity or a threat, as a friend or as a collaborator. And I think if you respect water, if we can respect water and understand all of the myriad things it's doing, understand its relationship with the underground, with microbes, with beavers, with humans, you know, we're doing this very kind of linear, single-minded problem solving when we build a dam or a levee. But if we're thinking in systems, if we're thinking of water with respect, asking what water wants, I think that's the shift that we need to live more peacefully and happily alongside water.
Well, we will leave it there. Erica, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic reporter. We talked with her today about her new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. On the point of water movement, we got an email from Jeff who said, to those who are planning to attend the Farm Technology Days in Loyal, Wisconsin this week, the Wisconsin DNR has a booth with a pretty cool watershed model. Jeff says they're able to show the importance of stormwater management, specifically stormwater ponds, to help reduce peak flow rates. Looks like that event runs today until the 14th of July. Jeff, thanks for the heads up on that. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, does Minnesota or Wisconsin have more lakes? Well, the answer depends on your definition of a lake. We'll talk with a researcher who started a project to define what makes a body of water a lake, a pond, or a wetland. Also, Wisconsin's dairy industry relies on workers from Mexico and Central America. We'll talk with the author of a new book about the state's workers, farmers, and the politics of immigration that surround the industry. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.